And Judea is finding itself under different governments because the Greek government is not, even though we think of it as this kind of umbrella culture, it's actually fractured pretty much as soon as Alexander dies. And each subculture has its own character. Under the Ptolemies, Judea has a lot of peace. They're practicing their religion pretty much unhindered. But in 200 BCE, when the Judeans find themselves under the Syrian Greeks, things go awry. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes issues this legislation saying these people in Judea, they're not good Greeks. They're adhering to their ancestral law. They are not participating in public festivals. Remember, in the ancient world, everything that is religious is public. Mm-hmm. So if you don't go to the festival of Dionysus, you are a bad Greek. And so when the Jews don't show up to these festivals, they are bad Greeks in the eyes of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. The Ptolemies don't care as much. And so there's a series of legislation between 200 and 175 BCE, basically saying you can no longer adhere to your ancestral law, right? And then we have the Hasmonean period. Now, we, I think, teach our children in, you know, first, second, third grade to lionize the Hasmoneans, that these Hasmoneans lay down their lives to fight the Syrian Greeks, that they gave everything up, right? That they were totally committed to their ancestral law and that they were fighting against the evils of a Greek culture. And that might have been true for the first generation of Hasmoneans. It might have even been true for the second generation of Hasmoneans. But when we get to the end of the second century BCE, so in the 130s, 120s, 110s, the Hasmonean monarchy that rules Judea is very, very different than the Hasmonean family that we think of from the 170s and 160s BCE. So when we think of the Hasmoneans, who do we think of?
The Maccabees.
We think of Judah, right? The Maccabees. We think of Judah and his four brothers, right? But we don't necessarily think of his descendants. Now, over time, the Hasmonean family becomes rife with corruption. There's collusion. It's kind of like a Victorian court with all the plots and the coups. And at the same time, there's increasing ambivalence about where loyalty should lie. And so there are actual Hasmoneans themselves, not just other Judeans, but Hasmoneans who are saying, we need to reach out and make nice to the Greeks. And there are other Hasmoneans who are saying, and we'll talk about some of them tonight, who are saying, even though I'm not eligible to be the high priest, I demand to be the high priest because I don't want anyone to parallel me in power. And so when we get to 103 BCE, which is when Alexander Janneus, Alexander Yanai, ruling Judea, Judea is kind of like this boiling pot of debate. The question of whether to assimilate has not been settled by autonomy. It's actually become more urgent and confused than it's ever been. Right? So we kind of think that in the beginning of the second century BC, there was this question, do we assimilate, right, or do we maintain our ancestral law? And then the Hasmoneans resolved that. And the answer is, we maintain our ancestral law. But in fact, whatever solution the Hasmoneans kind of put together was not enduring. And so there is still a split in Judea. In the second century, there's a, okay, you have a source sheet. There's still a split between the Jews. This is also the century that sees the rise of sectarianism. And so there are different groups of Jews who are arguing with each other on all kinds of topics. So what are the two big sects that we know of today? Because, you know, they're in the Mishnah. The Pharisees and the Sadducees, right? We also have the Essenes. We have the Hasidians, the Hasidim. We have, there are source sheets over here. Do you want to pass it back? Thank you. And there are different approaches. So does anybody know a very famous difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Sorry?
Pesach.
Okay, so they have a calendar difference. They have a calendar difference, and that's largely because the Sadducees do not accept any oral tradition, right? So the Pharisees have this parallel oral law that develops and builds on the written law, and the Sadducees do not accept. So whatever's in the Torah, that lunar calendar is not. This is a complicated question of how the rabbis intercalated the calendar, but. They didn't necessarily celebrate things at the same time. But what's a very fundamental difference between the Pharisees and the Sadducees? I mean, oral law versus written law, big deal, right? The Sadducees reject oral law. Anybody know another one? There are theological differences. The Sadducees do not believe in free will. They believe that everything is predestined, and they reject the entire concept of resurrection, which becomes very, very important in the rabbinic period. Okay, so, but there's also political differences. The Sadducees are known for being, are they low class, are they high class, who are these people? They're aristocrats, right? Many of the Sadducees are priests. But you can't say all the Sadducees are priests because these are fluid communities that you would choose to adhere to, right? You're born a priest or you're born not a priest, right? But you're not born a Sadducee and then condemned to being a Sadducee forever. There's a fluidity to these political movements. And there's a lot of interaction as well. The Pharisees, Josephus will tell us, has the people behind them. So the Pharisees are the most influential socio-religious group. And so these are the communities that are arising in the second century, and they have different perspectives as to what to do with the Greeks. Do we embrace Greek culture, or do we reject it? And what we will see when it comes to Alexander, Janaeus, and Salome is that Alexander supports, or he is supported by the Sadducees, and he embraces Greek culture, and Salome embraces the Pharisees, and she rejects all outside influence. Okay, so that's what we're going to see. We're going to look at two kinds of sources tonight, rabbinic sources, so we're going to start with later sources, and these sources, we're going to start with Alexander Janaeus, because to understand what Salome achieves, we need to start with her husband. So we're going to look at some sources about Alexander Janaeus, and then we will also look at Josephus. Does anybody know who Josephus is?
Historian,
late first century, brought up in a community right outside of Jerusalem. He says he's from priestly lineage. We don't know for sure. And what happens when the Great War erupts in 66 CE?
He recorded it.
He recorded it in the 90s, and he's appointed.
From the Roman point of view.
That's an interesting question.
Well, not completely, not completely from the Jewish point.
Exactly. He's kind of walking this tightrope. He's appointed to be a general over a Jewish garrison in the north. And when he realizes that this is an utterly losing battle, he doesn't defect exactly. He is captured by Vespasian. And when he's captured, he professes loyalty to Vespasian. Vespasian releases him. And the Flavian family commissions these works that he ends up writing. But he's always walking this tightrope of he is proud of his Jewish heritage, but he is also living in the Greek world by the end of his life. Okay, so we're going to look at rabbinic sources, and we're going to look at Josephus. These are not, to call them historical archives would be to misread these texts. We have to think about what they're doing polemically and what message is being conveyed here. So the Gemara is not interested in providing scientific history, but there is absolutely a very important message in rabbinic literature. Likewise with Josephus. Josephus is not objective. No scholar of the first century will tell you that Josephus should be read completely as this like scientific, you know, perfect history. Not at all. Okay. So let's look at this first source. This is in Kedushin. And this is a source that talks about the fall of Alexander Janaeus. What's interesting about this source is that it suggests that Alexander Janaeus, who I think many of us, Alexander Yanai, many of us think of this king, if you know anything about him, you know that he is just the worst, right? He is just an evil rabbi or Pharisee-hating, murderous, paranoid king, right? But what this source does is it kind of finesses that picture by suggesting that Yanai was actually just really a puppet. By the way, when I say Yanai or Alexander Janaeus, same person. So here, Alexander Yanai is kind of a puppet who's manipulated by a Judean, we don't know if he's a member of the court or just a high-level guy who consorts with kings, we don't know. Now, this Hebrew is not hard.
I can read it for you.
Okay, if you read it, I was going to say, you could volunteer to read in English or Hebrew. What's hard about it is only that there are no quotation marks, so you have to think about, okay, where's the quotation beginning and ending? But if you read it really loud, because we're being recorded over here, and also we want everyone to hear. Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I need 1 second.
Okay, sure.
Reading aids. V'haya shem echad, v'haya shem echad, ish lev ra u'blial.
Okay, really bad guy, right? live Rabbilia, just like the worst, right? A scoffer, a man of an evil heart, a scoundrel. Okay, and what's his name?
Ve'elazar ben Poira shmo. ויאמר אלעזר בן פוירה לינאי המלך, ינאי המלך, ליבם של פרושים עליך.
Okay, so what does this mean? Eleazar comes to Yanai and he has an agenda. And his agenda is to tell Alexander Yanai, there are people against you. We have the source sheets, I just don't know where they went. Oh, okay, they're back there. Okay, Alexander Yanai, you know who really hates you? The Prushim. Who are the Prushim?
Pharisees.
The Pharisees. They really can't stand you. Okay, so that's the end of that statement. And then Yanai answers, what do I do about it, right? Just totally helpless. This isn't like a conniving, controlling person who knows what he's doing. Just, I don't know, tell me what to do, Eleazar. Okay, so Eleazar says, okay, and so what should you put on your forehead or like somewhere on your, between your eyes or on your forehead, what should you put on? The tzitz. So this is, well, you can look at the English. This is from Safaria, and I didn't write this translation. Right? The priestly, what would you call it in English? Here it says front plate. It's a band, right? The band, the priestly band of the high, it's the high priestly band. So what would the message be? What Rabbi Galman is?
He said tzitz.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what the Gemara says. So if you were to envision it, it's something that goes around the head. And what would you understand about someone who wears this garment? You know that this is
a warrior.
Not just a warrior, but this is the high priest, right? Now, is Yanai... Okay, so Yanai is a monarch. His father's Hyrcanus. Not a good guy either, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Gotta get to it.
I'm trying to...
Hyrcanus is a supporter of the Sadducees, like his son Alexander Yanai. They're both no friends of the Pharisees. So this random guy, Eleazar ben Poira, says, okay, you're going to put on this high priestly garment and go in front of the Pharisees, and what will they understand from that? Well, what will they understand before you go on? What's the message here? Yeah, don't mess with me, because I am not only the political leader, I am the main religious authority here, right? You don't mess with me. And so he does this, right? Because he's a puppet. He's not a bad guy yet. This is the story of his downfall. This is like the genesis story of Alexander Yanai. Okay? So this is like where we're the starting point here. Every other source about Alexander Yanai is going to talk about how horribly evil he is. But in this story, this is like the only rabbinic agadah where he really isn't. Okay, so he's like, all right, sure. Okay, so keep going. Hekim.
Hekim lahem betzitz shebein enav.
Period. Haya
sham zaken echad v'Yehuda ben Gedida shmo. ויאמר יהודה בן גדידה לינאי המלך, ינאי המלך, רב לך כתר מלכות, הנח כתר כהונה לזרעו של אהרון.
Okay, so this Yehuda ben Gedidya, is that how you would say his name? Yeah. Okay, I'll say Gedidya. Says to King Yanai, look, you have the crown of monarchy. Shouldn't that be enough? Why do you need also the crown of priesthood? You know, lay off. We don't think you're eligible. Why not? Keep going.
שהיו אומרים, אמו נשבט במודיעים,
ויבוקש
הדבר ולא נמצא, ויבדלו חכמי ישראל בזעם.
Okay, so there was a rumor about Yanai that his mother did not conceive him with a descendant of a priest. Rather, she was raped in some kind of war situation, and she was taken captive, she was raped, and that is where Yanai comes from. This was a rumor, right?
Or even if it's just before that, like she would be disqualified from marrying
the Kohen. Right.
She was disqualified from marrying the Kohen.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Even if he wasn't conceived in that situation, right? Absolutely, she's disqualified. And if that is what happened to her, he cannot be the high priest. Yivukash HaDavar, this matter was looked into. Philonim saw, they didn't find anything to substantiate it, but this rumor was circulating, right? And so what happened to the sages? Oh, sorry. So what happened to the Chochmei Yisrael? They were expelled. So we don't exactly know what this means. And here, I think in this story, we have to understand the Chochmei Yisrael as being the Pharisees. So that's important for later on in the text. Okay, so Yanai was aware of this rumor about him. It was very undermining to his claim to the high priesthood. And so the people who are responsible for circulating this claim are excommunicated. Now this clown, Eleazar ben Poira, comes back to King Yana and says, just excommunicating? Or not excommunicating, but just expulsion? That's not enough, right? Who is this guy? We don't even know. But he's like the bug in Yana's ear. So what does he say?
ויאמר אלעזר בן פוירה לינאי המלך ינאי המלך, הדיוט שבישראל, כך הוא דינו, ואתה מלך וכהן גדול, כך הוא דינך.
Right, okay. So by the way, הדיוט is a Greek word, and it's a word that we use today in English. Anybody know what the English word is?
Idiot.
Okay, good. Idiot, right? But that's not what it means here. Hedjot just means like a lay person, right? So just like a non-priest lay person. So if you were just, you know, some regular guy, this would be a reasonable punishment, right? For someone to circulate this rumor and you are innocent, they should be expelled. But look, you're a king, you're a high priest. Shouldn't your judgment be a little more harsh? And again, Yanai replies the same thing. What does he say? So what should I do? And so then Eleazar replies,
אם אתה שומע להצעתי, רומסם בתורה מה תהיה עליה, הרי כרוכה ומונחת בקרן זווית.
Right, so Eleazar says, if you listen to my advice, crush them. In other words, kill them. And again, Yanai just has questions, right? He's not a bad guy yet. He is just allowing himself to be manipulated. Just like Ahasuerus, you know, in the Persian period, lets himself be manipulated. He's not on top of things. He's not leaning from the front. He's leaning from the back. Yanai says, but what will become of the Torah if we kill all these sages, all these Pharisees? And again, this text comes from the perspective that the Pharisees are the conservators of the Torah, including, you know, oral and written law, right? And so Eleazar says, oh, it's wrapped and placed in the corner, right? Anyone can read the Torah, right? We don't need the sages. But, I think that we skipped a little bit in the Gemara, but go to Amar, the last paragraph, Amar of Nachman Bar Yitzchak.
Amar of Nachman Bar Yitzchak, miyad nizrika bo apikursut.
Oh, I skipped something, sorry. Eleazar says, anyone can read it in the corner, right? We have no need for sages, meaning, oh, okay, no, I did that part. So we don't need them. And then Nachman Bar Yitzchak asked the question. Okay, keep going, sorry. Keep going.
Amar of Nachman Bar Yitzchak, miyad nizrika bo apikursut.
Another Greek word, yeah.
דהבה להי, למי מר, תנח תורה שבכתב, תורה שבעל פה מי מיד, ותוצץ הרעה על ידי אלעזר בן פוירה, ויארגר כל חכמי ישראל, והיה העולם משתמם עד שבא שמעון בן שטח, והחזיר את התורה ליושנה.
Okay, all right, so let's just look at the English because it's a little bit tough. Immediately heresy is injected into Yanai. He should have said to Eleazar, okay, so that's fine for the written Torah. Anybody can read the written Torah, but what about the oral Torah, which we need the sages for, right? And at the moment that Yanai did not say that, did not protest, and instead he agreed to kill the sages, that is the moment that the evil arises, and this is like very interesting turn of phrase, catches fire through Eleazar ben Poira, and all the sages of the Jewish people are killed. So in this Gemara, we don't know the number. Josephus will talk about a mass murder of Pharisees under the reign of Alexander, Yanai, 6,000. So that's a mass murder, you know, pretty shocking number. And there's another time where he kills 800 sages. But here we don't have a number, but there's a reference to a mass annihilation of enemies. Those enemies are Chochmei Yisrael. I think that is specific to the Purushim, right? These are people who believe in the oral law, so it cannot be the Sadducees. Alexander Yanai is a friend of the Sadducees. The Sadducees wouldn't be teaching oral law. This has to be specific to the Purushim, to the Pharisees. Okay, so we have this story, but really he's almost a puppet. Like he's kind of totally inactive, right? Asking questions, what should I do? What should I do? So what should I do? And who is this Eleazar ben Poira? We have no idea. The sages are killed. Maybe, right? But what we're going to see in a lot of these traditions about Yanai is that other people are killing on his behalf. Something about Yanai gets other people to murder, right? I mean, that's like a real level of evil. Not that he's murdering, but also he's getting other people to kill. So we're going to see that later on. Okay, so, but I think we have to maybe just do English because we're 8:25, we just did one source. So we're going to go a little faster. Okay, or unfortunately, you know, let's skip the Jesus text. This is a really weird text. Thank you. You know, I don't even think my phone's on silent. Yeah. Okay, but I don't get any phone. I just get texts. Okay. So where were we? This text in Sotah, I encourage you to read it on your own. I need to get to Salome Alexandra. But what I think is very bizarre about this text is that it places Jesus, this is the origin story of Jesus. Just like the first verse is the origin story of Yannai. This origin story of how Jesus became a heretic is placed in the historical context of Alexander Yannai, which does not make any sense, right? Alexander Yannai is, no, I mean, it doesn't, right? Because
if it's one heretic.
What do you mean? If
Jesus is all based on one heretic.
Okay, so I think, I mean, at least the reception history of this text is that this is about Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so we'll read it like, you know, we'll read it that way. It's very, very strange, right? This is someone who was killed, crucified by the Romans around 32 CE. Why is he being retrojected back into the period of the Hasmoneans, right? The Hasmonean monarchy ends in 63 BCE when General Pompey invades Jerusalem. The rabbis might not be historians, but I think they know enough to know that Jesus is not living under the time of Alexander Yannai. I think there's a very intentional juxtaposition here. But read it on your own time. Okay, let's go to source 3. Because this is another story in which Yannai makes other people kill. And we can't do all of it, but look at the English. This is on Hedron 19. The Mishnah teaches a king does not judge and is not judged. Right? And then there's a discussion here. We taught this halacha only, I'm on page 3, with regard to kings of Israel who are violent, but with regard to the kings of the house of David, the king is held responsible for his actions. So now look at the second paragraph. What does it mean that others cannot judge the king of Israel? That doesn't make sense, right? Everyone's human. Everyone's accountable. If anything, the Torah over-humanizes the king, right? Like if you read Devarim, all the laws about the king is that the king is limited and human, right? So what does it mean that this king is not subject to being judged? It's kind of counterintuitive with what we know about a Jewish king, right? So the Gemara gives an answer, right? You're right. Reader, with your Havamina, yeah, it's true that the king is human, right? But we don't judge kings of Israel, that is, kings who do not descend directly from David, because of an incident that happened. As the slave of Yannai, the king killed a person. Now, Shimon ben Shetach, we saw him in the first source. Who's Shimon ben Shetach? He's going to be very important when we talk about
him.
That's Salome Alexander, right? Shlomo Zion Malka's brother, right? And what's his role? Who is he? Right. So he's the Nasi, So he's running the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. He's running this consortium of rabbinic leadership. So let's call him like the most important Pharisee of the time, okay? I think that's fair. Now, it happens to be that Alexander and Shimon ben Shetach are in-laws because Alexander's married to Shimon ben Shetach's sister, Shlomo Zion Malka. So a little bit of an awkward Thanksgiving family dinner. I mean, I can only imagine what their dinner table was like. But, okay, so Shimon ben Shetach calls Yannai to account, right? He says to the sages, we need to judge Yannai because his slave killed someone. That means that Yannai is responsible for his slave's actions. Yannai should have seen to it that his slave didn't kill anybody. So we're going to make Yannai accountable, right? Your slave killed a person. So Yannai sends the slave to them, but they say, no. You also come here. You see where I am in the second paragraph of the source? You also come here. Go to the third paragraph. The Gemara narrates the incident. Yannai comes. He sits down. The Shimon ben Shetach says, no, don't be disrespectful. Stand up. Right? Anybody know this story? Stand up. You don't sit. We're, you know, the Anshei Knesset HaGedola. You stand up, not for our honor, but for God, right? Okay, so what does Yannai say at the end of the third paragraph? Yannai, the king, says back, I won't stand when you alone say this to me, but if all of your colleagues say stand up, I'll stand up. So what's Yannai doing here? It's a little clever, actually. It's like a challenge to all the rabbis, right? Make me your enemy, and I'll stand up. If you think you're so great, if you think you're above me, if you're so not afraid of me, then all of you tell me to stand up. See what happens. They don't stand up, right? I mean, what would you do? Now, by this time, presumably, he's already killed Pharisees. They know him to be a Pharisee killer. They are terrified of him. Nobody stands up. Shimon ben Shetach turns to his right, fourth paragraph. The judges forced their faces to the ground out of fear and said nothing. I mean, this is like a really vivid scene where they don't want to look at Shimon ben Shetach. They're embarrassed because they know what the right thing to do is. They don't want to look at Alexander Yannai. terrified of him, right? And then he turns to his left, and all the rabbis to his left are also forcing their faces to the ground, saying nothing. Shimon ben Shetach says, you are masters of thoughts, enjoying your private thoughts, not speaking, right? You're silent when you should be outspoken. You should be standing up to this evil king. May the master of thoughts, God, come and punish you. And then Gabriel, the angel, strikes those judges to the ground, and they've died. Again, Yanai makes other people kill, right? This all comes from Yanai's bad behavior. But what else strikes you about this story? I mean, we know, it depends how academic you want to be about this, but if we know that Yanai killed sages, to put it in this context and say it was really God, it was really the angel Gabriel, mm-hmm. right? What Yanai might have taken credit for killing the sages, but really it was Gabriel. That's theologically very typical of rabbis, right? When we have an enemy king who kills the Jews, the prophets always say, well, actually you did it to yourselves because you sinned, right? We kind of disempower Nebuchadnezzar. We say, well, Nebuchadnezzar was a divine vehicle, right? And so here I think that that could be happening here. The image here of God running the show and Yanai trying to, you know, trying to exert his power is a very striking contrast. Okay, at that moment... That is interesting. So what I would say to that is it seems to be worse to be a Pharisee who knows better, right? Because expectations are higher. These rabbis should have stood up to this evil, right? The Pharisees, right? That's the object of this rabbinic writer's frustration, right? Yanai, we know he's an evil guy from start to finish, right? And that's the source of this rule that a king does not judge others and we don't judge him due to the danger of the matter. So these members, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, were killed. Yanai makes people kill each other. Okay, I really want to get to Salome, but let's see if we can do... Okay, we have to talk about Josephus, because Josephus, let's say the rabbinic texts were written in the 5th or 6th century CE. Josephus is writing in 90 CE. He's not an eyewitness. And the biggest problem with Josephus often is that we don't know what his sources are. And sometimes his sources are very scholarly, and sometimes Josephus is trying to make a polemical point, and we don't know, you know, when he's using a source all the time. So when it comes to Alexander, of course, Josephus is not like Alexander at all. But don't assume that because Josephus hates Alexander, he likes Salome. He actually doesn't like either of them. He feels real animosity to the pair, which is interesting because Salome and Alexander are married, but very, very different. So this is what Josephus has to say about Alexander. We're in source 4 on page 4. As to Alexander, his own people were seditious against him, right? Nobody liked him. Now, this is already far into his reign. People have been killed. This is a very famous story, what Josephus is about to tell us. At a festival which was then celebrated, he stood upon the altar and he's going to sacrifice. Why? Because he claims to be
the priest.
Right, the high priest. So he gets up there to sacrifice. The nation rises upon him and pelts him with what? Right. What holiday, obviously?
Sukkot.
Right, so he comes out there. Everyone's making this pilgrimage holiday, right? Thousands. Josephus says, estimates that on Pesach, there were 250,000 people who come. No, there were 250,000 Korban Pesachs brought. And then you could estimate that there were 5 people to each Korban. And then from that, you get like a massive number. I mean, over a million people coming to Jerusalem on Pesach. So if that's happening also on Sukkot, we're talking... Maybe those numbers are exaggerated. We're talking tens of thousands of people coming to the Beit HaMikdash, right? And they are just throwing, that has got to hurt, right? Throwing their etrogs at. Can you imagine wasting a good etrog on Alexandriana? Okay, so the law of the Jews required that at the Feast of Tabernacles, everyone should have the palm tree and the citron. Okay. They reviled him, fifth line, as derived from a captive. So Josephus and the rabbinic text have the same rumor. And that suggests to me, the rabbis are not reading Josephus. They're not. So when you find something like this that's in Josephus, who's writing in Greek, in Rome, right, in the late 90s, and then you find something in rabbinic text, it's likely a very, very, very old source and probably an authentic source. So this rumor was an enduring rumor, right, that he derived from a captive. He was not eligible to be the high priest. And so unworthy of his dignity and of sacrificing, at this he was in a rage and he killed 6,000 people. Right, not so innocent in Josephus as he is in our first. What was our first from Well, where was it from? On page one?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't have my... Kiddushin. Right? Not as innocent. I mean, actually really quite sadistic. Oh, you don't like me? So I will go on a killing rampage. Then Josephus goes on to talk about a war that Yanai has with the Syrians. And when he retreats from the Syrians, this is the same big paragraph, five lines from the bottom, he goes back to Jerusalem, and the nation insults him with a civil war. So for 6 years, after Yanai loses to the Syrians, he is fighting for 6 years, the six-year-long coup, where the people are trying to, derail him from ruling. De-monarch? No, that is not a word. Dethrone. They're trying to dethrone him. For 6 years, there's this war against his supporters, which are primarily mercenaries. So he's hiring outside guys who have no stake in the matter, outside mercenaries, to fight against his own people. Sounds a little bit like Syria today. So this goes on for 6 years. Thousands. Oh, how many people are killed? No fewer than 50,000 of them. That's, you know, again, are Josephus's numbers spot on? It honestly doesn't matter to me. Something very, very big and horrible happened here, right? When he desired that they would desist from their ill will, they hated him so much more. In other words, when he maybe tries to make some kind of amends, they won't allow it because he's killed so many of them on account of what already had happened. And when he'd asked them what he ought to do, they all cried out, kill yourself. So this is not a popular king. And if his eyes are set against the Pharisees specifically, you can see from this source, the people really do follow the Pharisees. Right. It doesn't mean the majority of Judeans are Pharisees. Right? The number that Josephus says is maybe 6,000 people in Judea were Pharisees. But the people following the Pharisees, that's the majority of the people, the population. So I think we often think of this time as like, well, everyone had to be in a sect. No, not everyone had to be in a sect. The Pharisees were the transmitters of the oral law. They were teachers, right? They were leaders, but the people were following them. So if Alexander kills a bunch of Pharisees, almost the entire nation will rise up and cry out. Okay. All right, then they sent to Demetrius Eucharis, which is a Greek ruler of the Seleucid Empire, and they try to make a league with him to kill Alexander. It doesn't exactly work out. Skip to the bottom of the last paragraph. Alexander runs to the mountains, maybe to the east, maybe to the south. 6,000 of the Jews, again, we have the same number, come to him out of pity at the change of his fortune. So they say, okay, maybe we'll ally with you now that you're down on your luck. But we don't have to go on the ins and outs, but basically he gets the upper hand. We don't know why maybe these thousands of Jews came to Alexander because they thought, okay, if he really wins, we don't want him to kill us. Right? Mm-hmm. So a bunch of, let's say a few garrisons of Jews go and switch sides, and it enables him to defeat the rebels. So go four lines down, he takes the city, he gets his men into power. After 6 years of basically being ousted, he reestablishes himself as king. And what does he do? He's feasting with his concubines in the sight of all the city right after he quells the rebellion, and he orders 800 of the rebels to be crucified, the most horrible way of dying. I don't want to detail it, but you can easily go online and learn about it. It's not just being on a cross, it's you suffocate to death on the cross, but very, very, very slowly. And your nails are, there's a hole in your nails, and your ankles, terrible, terrible, slow, painful death. So he orders 800 of his enemies to be crucified. So this is not a Jewish way of putting people to death. Who crucifies? The Romans crucify, right? Right? He is no longer interested in playing the game of, you know, being part or kowtowing to Dante Misericordia. He is doing as the Romans do. He crucifies 800, totally humiliating. It's a public death. They're out there at night, right? You're not supposed to leave anyone out overnight, but it's a slow, slow, slow death. And then after they're dead, well, what the Romans would do is they would just leave them there to rot as a public warning. We don't know if their corpses were taken down or when. And then while they're still living, right, because it takes a few days to die on the cross, he ordered the throats of their children and wives to be cut before their eyes. So he takes all their families and kills them in front of these people who are being killed on the cross. I mean, this is mind-blowingly evil. And that's the Alexander Yanai that used to be this guy, right, to Eleazar Ben-Poira. And now he's totally sadistic. Okay, we have to go to Salome. But basically, his death sets the stage for utter just hopelessness when it came to the Judean leadership. How could his wife possibly make amends with the people when her husband was so reviled? I mean, probably, maybe next to Herod, but probably the most reviled king of all the Jews ever. I mean, he was just widely, widely detested, right? So what do you do when this guy dies and his wife and the wife takes over? It's kind of mind-blowing that when Salome takes the throne, that signals 9 years. 9 years is a long time for a ruler of this period. 9 years of peace. This is just like an incredible thing. She allies immediately with the Pharisees. She gives them power, and she allows them to have jurisdiction over the religious life of the Judeans. I do want to do some of this inside, even though we're limited for time. Now, Josephus, I said, doesn't like Salome. But I kind of presented her in positive terms. So what do you think he might not like about her? Just guessing.
Determination.
Oh, maybe she's like too strong of a woman. She should just know her place. Mm-hmm. Well, what he really doesn't like about her is how much control he gives the she gives the Pharisees. Maybe you're not wrong, but he does not think that she made a smart move by empowering this body of leaders. Okay, so Alexander's about to die. Look at this source, Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, on page 5, underlined. His queen sees that he's ready to die. He has no longer any hopes of surviving, and she's terrified. She comes to him weeping and lamenting and bewails herself. Why is she afraid? Now remember, she's the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, right? He married her for political reasons, to get some acceptance from the people, which then he squanders, right? So it's a totally political marriage. Now, she's part of this very prestigious Pharisaic family. Why is she afraid? She thinks that they're so, that the people have such ill will towards Alexander that any clout she has as a member of Shimon's family will be worthless, and that immediately the people are going to kill her. Immediately. They want to be rid themselves of this terrible family. So she comes in crying. He's on his deathbed, and she's worried about her future, and she has two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, and she's worried about them as well. We'll see that one, Hyrcanus is a Pharisee, Aristobulus is a Sadducee. They fight against each other after she dies. Okay, so she says, "To whom do you leave me and my children, who are destitute of all supports, and this when you know how much ill will your nation bears thee?" This is a very bad translation because it's free online. Any good translation won't be free online. He gave the following advice: that she need but follow what he would suggest to her in order to retain the kingdom securely with her children. She should conceal, this is very smart, she should conceal his death until she took his place. So she would announce, "Oh, Alexander is unable to rule. I'm going to be the queen regent. I will rule in his stead." Right? After this, she should go and triumph as upon a victory to Jerusalem and put some of her authority into the hands of the Pharisees, and then she should announce Alexander's death. Make friends, right? Claim some power. I'm going to let you, you know, even, like, don't announce my death, even if I've already died. Say that you are ruling, and then go reach out to the Pharisees. And then he says, which is kind of selfless, you can hate on me a little bit. You can tell them how much you hated me, which suggests that maybe there was a little bit of love in their relationship, which is kind of shocking. I don't know if that's possible. I don't know. I leave that as a question mark. But he is a little bit sacrificial over here. He says, okay, they would commend her for the honor she had done them and would reconcile the nation to her, for he told her that they had great authority among the Jews, both to do hurt to such as they hated and to bring advantages to those to whom they were friendlily disposed. Josephus, you might be able to tell, doesn't love the Pharisees. He thinks that they are manipulative, but that's for a different shear. Okay, so basically what he says to her, we can't do this all inside, is to say to the Pharisees, you can do whatever you want with his body. Right? You could do whatever you want. And so she says to the Pharisees, I don't want anything to do with him. I hated him. I don't care if you give him a funeral. And then what do? They give him a nice funeral. Playing right. It's like so psychological. So like if you look at the end of this first paragraph, if you say this to them, 4 lines to the bottom, I shall have the honor of a more glorious funeral from them than you could have made for me. So he knows that the only way to get an actual funeral is for her to say, do whatever you want with this body. I hate him. Okay. So Alexandra acts as her husband has suggested. She speaks to the Pharisees. She puts all things in her power, both as to the dead body and as to the affairs of the kingdom, and she pacifies their anger against Alexander. So she makes friends with the Pharisees. But before we turn the page, is this alliance with the Pharisees sincere?
No.
Not at all. Why is she allying herself with the Pharisees?
To save herself.
Right, so she doesn't get killed. This is going to be a very interesting difference with the later rabbinic literature. The rabbinic literature loves Salome. They talk about her piety, her sincerity. Now, of course, it reflects a Pharisaic perspective. Josephus is very cynical. I can't tell you what the objective thing is, but I am just showing you the sources. Josephus doesn't think at all that her alliance was sincere. He thinks that it was political. The rabbis think it was sincere. Right? There's even a street in Yerushalayim named after Shlomo Zion HaMalka. So she gets a good rap in our tradition, and maybe deservingly so. But Josephus thinks it's all fake. Okay, now you can turn the page. All right. So I want to get to the part where he really insults her, but we might be okay. We have to get to the rabbinic stuff too. Okay. So look at page 6. We'll just focus on the underlined. So she has these two sons. Hyrcanus is unable to manage public affairs. Under the top paragraph. He delighted in a quiet life. Now he's going to ally himself later with the Pharisees. The younger Aristobulus, he follows Alexander, right? And Alexander's father's Hyrcanus. This is confusing because Alexander has a father named Hyrcanus. You know what? You went through all the trouble of bringing this, and I haven't used it. So I have to, okay. So we have, we only have 14 minutes left. Okay. So we have Hyrcanus over here. And then we have Alexander, his son, right? And then we have two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. It happens to be that if you look at a family tree of the Hasmonean family, like every woman is Miriam or Salome, and every man is Aristobulus or Hyrcanus. It is very confusing. Right? Alexander the Great is married to Salome, and her brother is Shimon. Right? Okay. So, these guys are Sadducees. Hyrcanus is a Sadducee, or he allies with the Sadducees. Alexandriana is a Sadducee. Aristobulus is a Sadducee. Hyrcanus is a Pharisee. Salome is a Pharisee, or so she claims. And Shimon ben Shetach is a Pharisee, right? So we have this kind of like equal power balance that becomes unequal after Alexander dies. Okay, so the younger Aristobulus is an active and bold man, and he actually wants to rebel against his mother. We'll see later, he wants to kill his mother because he thinks that she is being controlled by the Pharisees. Okay. We should do this. Okay. There's a whole question of who she's going to groom to take over. She likes Hyrcanus, right, unsurprisingly. And she makes him high priest, but Aristobulus resents her a lot for that, and he is trying to kill Hyrcanus and her. Look at the underline. The queen also took care of the affairs of the kingdom and got together a great body of mercenary soldiers, right? Something that her husband did too. This is kind of a new thing, to hire outside soldiers. It's very risky. Why is it risky to hire mercenaries?
Loyalty.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right, and like you said, there is no loyalty. They have nothing at stake in the matter, so they are viable. So just like her husband fights his own people with mercenaries, so she does that too, and I think that Josephus is implicitly critical of that. She increases her own army to such a degree, she became terrible to the neighboring tyrants, and she took hostages of them. One of the reasons why I think the rabbis like Salome is because she is very daring when it comes to the broader region, and she does win all these local wars. The country becomes entirely at peace because she quells all these little unsettled regions, and she incorporates those regions into the empire. But the Pharisees become a problem. They turn against her. They disturb the queen. Look, it's right here. They desire that she would kill those who persuaded Alexander to slay the 800 men. Ah, could this be Eleazar ben Poira? Should I say it again?
Yes.
You got to look at the source, right? Okay, so there are people who are pressuring Salome to kill the people who persuaded Alexander to kill Pharisees. Because again, what is Alexander, what do we know about him? We know that he, first of all, initially he listens to people when they tell him to do bad things, and then people do very bad things because of him. Right? He's very initially manipulatable, and then he's very manipulative. So these Pharisees are saying to Salome, kill all those people who convinced Alexander to murder the Pharisees. Following? I think they might be saying, kill Elazar ben Pu'ira and his followers. It's possible. Okay. And you know what? Alexander says yes. So they start killing some of these people. One is called Diogenes. Plenty of Jews in Judea had Greek names. It does not indicate whether you're assimilated or not. And after him, they did the same to several until Aristobulus says, okay, enough. I am going to organize a coup against my own mother because he's killing my friends. And so then we have another war. And this is a war between Aristobulus on the one hand and Salamine and her son Hyrcanus on the other. Now she wins by a hair, but go to the bottom of page 6. The queen was very affected. Can you imagine your own son trying to kill you? I would be affected too. She falls into a dangerous distemper, and Aristobulus resolves to attempt, again, we see it above, but to attempt once and for all to seize the government. He steals away by night. He gathers his friends. He takes a fortress. As he had been a great while displeased at his mother's conduct, he was now more afraid because his whole family is under the power of the Pharisees. Okay. Now, again, this fight between Aristobulus and Hyrcanus is kind of ongoing until her death. And even after her death, there's a big question, and they have to go to the Romans. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus appeal to the Romans saying, pick one of us, you know, support one of us, because we just keep killing each other, so take a side. They both think that their side will be picked. Okay, so look at the end. This is what we call an encomium. Anyone know what an encomium is? So it's usually a praise. It's kind of like the final say on this person's life. Usually it's praiseworthy, but it's like, okay, so what do we have to say about this person? It's kind of like a eulogy. What's the final word? What do we want to say about her? Okay. She died, right? You see the paragraph on the middle, page 7? Mm-hmm. She'd reigned 9 years. She lived until 73. She was a woman who showed no signs of the weakness of her sex. She was sagacious to the greatest degree in her ambition. Josephus talks a lot about how ambitious she is. I think I'm going to have to skip the Jewish war, but he talks about her ambition in that source too. And demonstrated by her doings at once that her mind was fit for action, and that sometimes men themselves show the little understanding they have by the frequent mistakes they make in point of government. Okay, he goes on and on. This is very Greek. She always preferred the present to futurity, so she was self-preserving to a fault. She preferred the power of an imperious dominion above all things. And in comparison of that, had no regard to what was good or what was right. When I read this for the first time, I didn't see this coming. It really goes downhill. She brought the affairs of her house to such an unfortunate condition, Josephus tells us, that she was the occasion of the taking away that authority from it. He is blaming the Roman takeover of Judea in 63 BCE on Alexandra, because when she dies, there's no stability. Hyrcanus and Aristobulus are fighting, and then Pompey the general invades Jerusalem, and then from then on, Judea is a client kingdom of Rome. And then in 6 CE, Judea is totally incorporated into the empire. And he and Josephus are saying, it all started with Alexandra, because she sided with the Pharisees, and she was disloyal to her own family. I mean, this is a very surprising angle that Josephus is taking, because he also admits technically there was peace with the region. And the people liked her. That's like the biggest thing. But he doesn't regard her monarchy as successful. And we'll see that the rabbis have a very different perspective. In no long time afterwards, which she had obtained by a vast number of hazards and misfortunes, and this out of a desire of what does not belong to a woman, and all by a compliance in her sentiments with those that bear ill will to her family, by leaving the administration destitute of a proper support of great men. So when she died, there was total confusion about who was going to take over. Her management during her administration while she was alive was such as filled the palace after her death with calamities and disturbance. Although this had been her way of governing, she preserved the nation in peace. I mean, that's pretty uncomplimentary. I'll give her the fact that she had 9 years of peace and that everyone loved her, but I don't like the fact that what she did by allying with the Pharisees caused strife in the monarchic family. One has to wonder why Josephus is so negative about Alexandra, because it doesn't seem to me to completely add up. And as a historian, I'm not interested in like making neat bows and giving you final answers. I think it's an interesting question that we should have about Josephus. What is really like getting his goat about Alexandra? Is it just that she's a woman? I don't think so. But he doesn't love the Pharisees. Let's wrap up with two incredible sources that are preserved, one Ta'anit and one Vayikra Rabbah. We only have 5 minutes. But I want to demonstrate how very deeply the rabbis appreciated and I think truly loved Shlom Tzion HaMalkah, Salome Alexandra. She really turned a period that was characterized by just mass murder, total instability, and terror. And there's no record of her killing anyone except for those who convinced Alexandra to kill Pharisees. There's no record of her going on any rampages to preserve her own integrity. It's just not there. And I think if it was there, Josephus would mention it. So let's look at the last source.
She hired the mercenaries?
She hires the mercenaries because she's being attacked by her son. Yeah. Yeah, so I don't think she's killing like lay people. I wouldn't compare that to what Alexandra does by crucifying the 800 sages and their children and their wives in front of them. Okay, so let's look at the last. This is a very famous statement. And then I didn't provide the translation for Vayikra Rabbah because it's almost identical to Talmud except for one interesting difference. And I have to see if I could find it. Yeah, there it is. Okay, so let's look. Does somebody want to read As We Found in the Days of Shimon ben Shetach? Or you could read it in Hebrew. Well, let's see if we can find someone else.
Anybody volunteer? I'd love you to hear my voice.
Well, you did a great job.
But on page 8, right?
Let's have Rabbi Gelman.
Uh-oh. You'd like English?
It doesn't make a difference.
Okay. As we found in the days of Shimon ben Shetach, that rain variably fell for them on Wednesday eves and Shabbat eves.
Okay, so that's like a big blessing, right? We know on Wednesday night and Friday night, if that's when rain comes, that's a bracha.
Until wheat grew as big as kidneys, mm-hmm. and barley as big as olive bits, and lentils as golden dinars.
Wow, so what does that mean? So what are
abundant.
We being told? Right, I mean, uh-huh. like everything is super fertile. Now we know from the Torah that when we're good, what happens? We get rain, right? What happens when there's the rain in the right times? We get a great produce, and here it was a phenomenal produce. What happens when we're very bad?
We get nothing.
Famine, right? Sure. Famine and no rain. And so here, what is this a sign of that Shlom Tzion HaMalkah had?
God's approbation.
She had divine approval. So God loved Shlom Tzion HaMalkah. But it's not in the days of Shlom Tzion HaMalkah. It's in the days of Shimon ben Shetach. So you need to look at Leviticus Rabbah, which is the same source, the same story, almost word for word, except... Look at the third line, Maaseh, Bimei Shimon ben Shetach, Ubimei Shlom Tzion HaMalkah. And that's why I want to include Vayikra Rabbah with the more famous Talmudic passage, because the Talmudic passage doesn't have her name, but it's very important that we know, and Leviticus Rabbah is an older source, I'm quite confident, it's an older source, and so the closer to the time of Shlom Tzion HaMalkah, we have a thank you card from the rabbi. Saying, we believe that everything good that came during your 9-year reign reflects the divine approval that you enjoyed.
Do we know if the rabbis, the Talmud, who finish off editing the Talmud, are more down on, or more approve more of, let's say, Josephus's canon than the rabbis who are the Amoraim in
Tvara? That's a great question.
Meikra Rabba, in other words, are they adopting his approach?
It's a great question. I mean, there's very little to say that the rabbis were actually reading Josephus. However, there are many, and there needs to be more scholarship done on this, there are many stories that make their way into Agadah, Midrashic and Talmudic Agadah, that we see in Josephus. I mean, the very famous story of, this actually might be in Philo, but it's a story of baby Moshe pushing the coals away and choosing the jewels, and the angel moves his hand to the coal. That's actually in Philo. But in Philo and Josephus, we have stories. And this is first century that make their way into later. Right. But I don't think that they're reading Josephus. I think that there are things circulating in the air that are being passed on in the oral tradition.
Right. The timeline, though, so yeah. if it's later, does it coincide with Josephus' writings as opposed to Vayikra Rabbah?
No, I think Vayikra Rabbah is post-Josephus.
They both are.
They both are, but I think that the Talmud is after Vayikra Rabbah, if I had to date it. Yeah, neither of these are... Well, I mean...
Why did they leave out Shmuel and Tzion HaMalkah?
It could just be for, I don't like need to condemn this as like an anti-woman source, but I think that Shimon ben Shetach was the better known figure by then.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very famous person, but who was also credited with preserving the tradition in the face of secularization and integration, which the Hasmoneans themselves had fallen into. And I think part of what's so interesting about this period is that it really reveals kind of the true face of the Hasmonean family, or the multifaceted dynamic of the family, because, you know, again, we think of the Hasmoneans as saving the tradition. Well, yes, in 175 to 164 BC, that was happening. But by the end of the first, or the second century BC, we have a total breakdown in unanimity when it comes to the monarchic family. I mean, there's just no consensus. No one is getting along. People are killing each other. And it doesn't really get resolved in an enduring way with Alexandra, but we have a respite. We have a 9-year respite. She dies. Her sons get added again. Rome gets involved and just takes over. So it's kind of a sad end, right? The Hasmonean monarchy only lasts a century, from 164 BCE to 63 BCE. It's just 100 years. It's kind of a sad end to what we think of as like the glory days of the Judeans. The glory days of the Judeans were maybe a couple decades. But Shlomo Tzion HaMalkah is credited in rabbinic history with really allowing the Pharisees to teach and to develop their oral tradition, and the rabbis appreciate that. So maybe, you know, she didn't save the Jewish people in a, you know, long-term way, but she did offer a glimmer of hope to the proto-rabbinic community of the Pharisees.
They omitted her from the Babylonian
Talmud. I don't think that this is like a policy thing. Like, we will not put Shlomo Tzion HaMalkah in the Babylonian Talmud. I think that whoever wrote this down wanted to give full credit to Shimon ben Shetach. You know, I'd have to search her to see if she's mentioned in the Talmud and other sources, but it's tough with her because her name appears in different ways. Sometimes she's Shlomtza, sometimes she's Shlomo Tzion, and sometimes the Vav is there, and sometimes it's not. But somebody just wrote a book. I can't remember his name. Kenny Atkinson is his name. Kenneth Atkinson just wrote a book. He's a scholar, but he wrote a book compiling all the ancient sources about Salome Alexandra. Haven't read it, but he's a good scholar, so I should read it. All right, well, that's it. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.